طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Welcome to the May 4th edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by Sharif Pham and continued in his loving memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. Now, something a little bit different here. There is a event today here in Boston commemorating an anniversary of the Holocaust. Well, there's also a protest of this, and we were contacted, in contact, with a Rabbi Weiss, who gave us a quick sort of off-the-cuff statement. I apologize if some of this is a little difficult to understand, and I don't have a transcript available for this, but this is Rabbi Weiss explaining why protest the Zionist commemoration of the Holocaust. Here it is.
With the help of the Almighty, this is Rabbi Yisrael David Weiss from the Turei Kanza International Jews United Against Zionism. We will be going and joining a demonstration in Boston on May 4th, Sunday, this coming Sunday, in front of the Faneuil Hall, and then they will be going over to where the Zionists are commemorating the Holocaust. The reason for our demonstration is simply because we would like to clarify and educate to the world that the Zionists have no right whatsoever to portray themselves as the representatives of the Jewish people or of the Jewish religion, and the idea of them commemorating the Holocaust, we find repugnant. We, the religious Jewish communities from around the world, we are from New York. My grandparents were killed in Auschwitz, and the majority of my relatives and the relatives of my colleagues, they suffered because they were Jews. Zionists want to claim the right to the Jewish entity, and it's totally false, because Judaism is subservient to God, it's a spiritual, it's religion, it has nothing to do with land grabbing. We, on the contrary, according to the Torah, forbidden to make even 1 inch of Jewish sovereignty, even if it would not affect another people, and certainly the concept of occupying another people, stealing, killing, this is all against the Torah. The concept of the State of Israel, which is the fulfillment of Zionism, is totally anathema to Judaism, forbidden according to Judaism, and the Zionists like to use the symbols of Judaism, the Star of David, the name Israel, and unfortunately, the great tragedy of the Jewish people, the Holocaust. They like to use that, try to glean sympathy and guilt ride up from the world who has been silenced by the Holocaust, and they try to use that people should support them in their occupation, or at least that the world should be silent on what they are doing to the Palestinian people. We as Jewish people object in the strongest manner. We would like the world to know that we do not want, we are totally opposed to this occupation. We're not about to steal and kill, as I said. On the contrary, the Muslim countries and the people of Palestine were our friends, neighbors, and there was never a conflict of religion. We were able to coexist, as we have many people who are alive today can testify to the fact that we have lived together in harmony in the same courtyard, babysat each other's children. And the contrary, the Muslim countries provided a safe haven for the Jews throughout history, whether it was by the Inquisition, by the Crusades, or by World War II. Whether it was sometimes bumps in the road, it were. But it is definitely not a religious conflict, and we were able to flourish in Muslim countries as in Palestine. There was never a requirement of the human rights groups or United Nations to protect us. The only problem, the root of bloodshed and suffering that has been ongoing for over 60 years, and more in Palestine and the Holy Land is because of the existence of this Ersatz Judaism called Zionism, trying to transform the religion Judaism into a nationalism. And they are constantly trying to use Jewish subjects, Jewish issues, as I've said, to get support. And especially the Holocaust is their main way of gaining support. It's maybe you could say the Zionists are the only ones who benefit from this terrible tragedy of the Holocaust. So again, therefore we are going to Boston, God help, to educate, to let the world understand that they have no right to speak about the Holocaust. I don't want to get into the whole issue about how the Zionists actually worked together with the Nazis to have the Jews go up to Palestine, and later in the Holocaust, they also tried to thwart efforts of saving Jews. That can be all seen on my site, which is nkusa.org, nkusa.org. But that's basically the reason why we are going out to demonstrate. Our hearts cry for the suffering of the Palestinian people. Our hearts cry, and we are humiliated that our name is being sullied, that it is being used for this occupation. And our hearts cry, of course, for the suffering both of the Palestinian people, the Jewish people, who are under this occupation, who are being trampled upon by the State of Israel, and the growth of anti-Semitism around the world because people equate Judaism and Zionism. Let the world know the truth. And we pray to the Almighty for a speedy and, God help, peaceful removal of this impediment to peace, the occupation, the State of Israel, so we can once again serve God together in harmony, the Jews, the Muslims, the Christians, the Arabs, all of us, as we have been doing for all these hundreds of years. We hope, with God's help, we should be successful. We ask and we invite everybody to come and join us in this demonstration across from in Boston from Faneuil Hall and the other second part of the demonstration when they go to the Holocaust commemoration. Be there, join us, and have an open mind for our message. Study it and you will see it is the truth. It is the voice of Jews around the world who have the truth to Judaism for hundreds of years. The more the religious, the Jew, the more they object to this occupation, the more clear the statement is if you will study the subject. God help, we are certain that you will understand and support what we are doing, and with God's help, when the world sees this, we understand that they will stop this occupation, and ultimately, the Almighty, with His compassion, will bring an end to it. We pray that it should be speedy and peaceful, and that we can once again give the Palestinian people their freedom, their self-identity, their pride, their everything that what a human being requires. Assalamu alaikum, shalom aleichem, and peace to all.
We continue
today's broadcast with the weekly news update, courtesy of the International Middle East Media Center. Following the news update is a podcast from the Electronic Intifada, interviewing writers from Gaza, plus more news headlines. The podcast was originally recorded on April 29th. Stay tuned for another thought-provoking segment of This Week in Palestine.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for April 25th to May 2nd, 2014. A Palestinian lawyer dies due to Israeli army torture this week. Meanwhile, the United States remains hopeful that peace talks between Palestinians and Israelis will resume. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report as usual with the nonviolent activities organized in the West Bank. On Friday, six civilians were injured when Israeli troops attacked the anti-wall and settlement protests organized at West Bank villages. IMEMC's Majd Bajali has more.
5 civilians were injured and many others suffered effects of tear gas inhalation when troops attacked the weekly anti-wall and settlements protests at the village of Al-Nabi Saleh. Local residents said that troops attacked protesters before leaving the village and fired tear gas into nearby residents' homes, causing damage. Israeli soldiers also invaded Al-Nabi Saleh and fired rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas at local youth. All 5 injured were hit by rubber-coated steel bullets. In the nearby Bil'in and Na'lin villages, Israeli soldiers attacked the protesters as soon as they reached the gate of the wall that separates local farmers from their lands. In Bil'in, one local youth was slightly wounded. Meanwhile, many other protesters were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation at both locations. Meanwhile, on Friday, Israeli troops attacked the villagers of Al-Ma'sara and their supporters at village entrance, then forced them back using rifle butts and batons. No injuries were reported. For INEMC News, this is Mr. Joe.
Hours after the deadline for Palestinian-Israeli peace talks, U.S. John Kerry still hopes that the two parties would consider resuming the negotiations. Meanwhile, Israel warns President Abbas against a recent reconciliation deal with the Islamist Hamas party in Gaza. IMEMC's Ram El-Meghari has the story.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry believed that peace negotiations could be resumed once both Palestinians and Israelis realized significance of those talks. Kerry's remarks came in the backdrop of recent Hamas-Fatah reconciliation deal that the U.S. considered counterproductive to peacemaking. Israel, from its part, declared a unilateral halt of peace talks with the Palestinian Authority and demanded President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah to retreat the deal, though some Israeli officials preferred to wait and see in light of latest Abbas's remarks that the upcoming national consensus government will be his own and will follow up on his footsteps. Abbas has reaffirmed his stance that he opts for negotiations and recognizes Israel, but not a Jewish identity of the Israeli state, as Israel has repeatedly demanded. In the Gaza Strip, Hamas's influential leaders, such as Mahmoud al-Zahar, reiterated Hamas's position that the party will never recognize Israel's right to exist, based on the fact that Israel is an occupying power that has taken over Palestine for more than 6 decades now. This week, Palestinian National Council convened in Ramallah over the negotiations with Israel and some other related issues. The council involves all Palestinian factions, excluding Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. Delegation of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine withdrew from the meeting in a protest of what they termed continued security coordination with Israeli occupation. Meanwhile, political analysts in Gaza told IMEMC that the latest unity agreement between Fatah and Hamas is cautiously welcomed. For IMEMC News, I'm Rami Al-Meghari in Gaza.
This week, one man was killed and another injured due to Israeli army and settlers' attacks. Moreover, Israeli troops kidnapped at least 41 civilians during invasions targeting Palestinian communities in the West Bank and Gaza this week. IMEMC's Iman Abid Rabbu Bannoura reports.
A Palestinian lawyer was found dead in his apartment on Tuesday after being tortured during a 45-day detention by Israeli forces, according to the Palestinian Prisoners' Society. Amjad Al-Safadi, aged 39, was beaten, shocked, and put under continuous observation, leading to extreme psychological distress, ultimately pushing him to commit suicide, a statement by the organization said. Earlier in the week, a Palestinian man was injured after being hit by a settler's car while working in Bitar Elit illegal settlement near Bethlehem. The sources said that Shaban Abdullah Kandil, 32, suffered various bone fractures and bruises and was moved to the Arab Society Hospital and Rehabilitation Center in the nearby city of Beit Jala. Also this week, the Israeli army demolished a number of Palestinian homes in different parts of the West Bank. The Israeli army demolished 2 Palestinian homes in Al-Arub refugee camp near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem on Wednesday. According to local sources, several heavy vehicles invaded the area, including farmlands, fired several gas bombs and concussion grenades at the residents, and demolished two homes. The homes are more than 200 square meters each. The soldiers also demolished walls around the properties and uprooted olive and fig trees and grape vines. On Tuesday, several Israeli military jeeps and bulldozers invaded Khirbet al-Tawil village near Akraba town, south of the northern West Bank city of Nablus, where they demolished a mosque and several sheds. Local sources said the soldiers displaced several families, rendering them homeless, and threw their belongings away. They added that the soldiers attacked the residents and dragged them out of their homes. On Friday, the Israeli army issued military orders to cut and uproot hundreds of Palestinian trees near a bypass road used by Israeli settlers close to Madama village, south of northern West Bank city of Nablus. The army said the decision was motivated by security considerations to ensure protection for Jewish settlers driving to and from their illegal settlements. In Gaza this week, several armored Israeli military vehicles invaded on Thursday an area of East Khan Yunis city in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Army bulldozers destroyed Palestinian lands. Local sources reported that at least 8 military bulldozers and vehicles advanced nearly 100 meters into Palestinian lands through the Abu Rida area. The invading vehicles used smoke screens during the invasion, while military vehicles stationed nearby fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition into the area as Palestinian workers were collecting gravel used in constructions. No injuries were reported. For IMEMC News, this is Iman Abdurrahman Noura.
And that's all for today from This Week in Palestine. This was the weekly report for April 25th to May 2nd, 2014, from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This week's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, we'll spend time with three writers and contributors to Gaza Writes Back, a brand new collection of short fiction written by young storytellers in Gaza. Rawan Yahi, Rifat Al-Arir, and Yusuf Al-Jamal talk about their work written after Israel's attacks on Gaza in 2008-2009, the power of short stories to illuminate daily life under occupation, and the reaction to their work as they tour the U.S.
We believe in the power of the word, how it mobilizes for the just cause of Palestine.
I thought a child's experience must be talked about, must be exposed, so that it doesn't happen to more children in the world.
And the Student Senate at UC Riverside passes divestment, along with the graduate student government at the University of New Mexico this week. And after significant pressure by student human rights activists, Northeastern University in Boston lifts the suspension of Students for Justice in Palestine. Plus, more news headlines. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland. First, we go to news headlines. After 7 weeks of sustained media attention and organizing by student activists, Northeastern University in Boston announced on April 22nd that it has lifted the suspension of Northeastern Students for Justice in Palestine. Not only will the group be fully reinstated on September 1st, but they will have access to more funding for educational events than was available before the March 7th suspension. Northeastern SJP will be able to plan for those events immediately. The group was suspended in an unprecedented sanction by the administration after students distributed mock eviction leaflets on campus, a popular direct action many Palestine solidarity groups undertake during the annual Israeli Apartheid Week to raise awareness about Israel's destruction of Palestinian homes. homes. The administration also launched a police investigation and threatened two of the students involved in the mock eviction action with charges that could have led to suspension or expulsion. The threat of expulsion was rescinded after an outpouring of condemnation by Northeastern SJP activists and supporters across the U.S. Northeastern SJP says that they attribute the reversal of the administration's punitive actions against the group to the media attention and the uninterrupted pressure placed on the university since the suspension. Student Tori Porel told the Electronic Intifada that SJP will be immediately focused on building the group. Quote, "We've had so much more interest in SJP with more people wanting to get involved since all this happened," she said. "This is a great time to educate others on campus about Palestine and grow SJP." Meanwhile, last Wednesday evening, the Student Senate at the University of California at Riverside voted to support a resolution sponsored by Students for Justice in Palestine, calling on the university to pull its investments from U.S. companies profiting from Israel's occupation. Student senators voted to uphold the resolution by a narrow margin, 8 in favor and 7 against, during an evening in which three separate California universities held divestment resolution hearings, dubbed a divestapalooza by student activists and boycott advocates on social media. This was the second time that a divestment resolution passed at UC Riverside. In March 2013, the Student Senate voted in favor of divestment. Immediately after the vote, on and off-campus Israel advocates had begun calling and emailing the student senators, claiming that the divestment resolution was, quote, divisive and that it, quote, misrepresented the student body. In April 2013, the Student Senate voted to rescind the divestment resolution. Activists with Students for Justice in Palestine at Riverside and the wider SJP West coalition vowed to, quote, come back fighting. And in related news, over the weekend on April 26th, the Graduate and Professional Student Association at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque passed a divestment resolution calling for transparency of investments, a social responsible investment committee, and divestment from the corporations that profit off of the human rights violations in occupied Palestine and here on the U.S.-Mexico border. This divestment resolution was co-sponsored by 9 different organizations on campus. And last week, the Earth Day Network, which promotes the annual Earth Day Environmental Consciousness Initiative, cut ties to a campaign launched by Israeli occupation profiteer SodaStream and endorsed by its spokesmodel, Scarlett Johansson. The U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation stated in a press release that, quote, "On the eve of Earth Day, groups working for Palestinian rights globally are celebrating Earth Day Network's decision to end its partnership with SodaStream, whose main production factory is located in an illegal Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank. Earlier this month, SodaStream, which markets its home carbonating devices as a green alternative to bottled beverages, announced the launch of an awareness-raising campaign centered around the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Groups in the United States and abroad mobilized opposition to this partnership between EDN and SodaStream due to the company's complicity in Israel's military occupation, including the destruction that Israeli settlements have caused to the Palestinian environment. In response, EDN no longer lists SodaStream as a sponsor. As the campaign to boycott SodaStream gains momentum, supporters have a new resource to use in their advocacy and education work. The slick website burstthebubble.org, launched by Jewish Voice for Peace's Seattle chapter, makes the case in plain language for why the carbonated beverage device manufacturer should be boycotted. SodaStream's attempts to brand its product to consumers concerned with social responsibility is busted in a series of short videos which are simple and effective. You can find out more on burstthebubble.org. And finally, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, was permitted to make a delivery of 300 food packages to Yarmouk camp near Damascus on April 24th, after 15 days of being denied access by the Syrian government. However, the delivery is a drop in the ocean of what is needed in the besieged refugee camp, where an estimated 18,000 civilians remain trapped. UNRWA says it needs to deliver 700 food parcels per day to prevent starvation in the camp, where many residents have already died of hunger, The Guardian reported this month. However, an average of only 100 parcels per day have been delivered since the beginning of the year, despite the UN Security Council's adoption of Resolution 2139 on February 22nd, requiring all parties in Syria's civil war to allow unfettered humanitarian assistance. According to a joint statement issued last week by UN agencies attempting to alleviate the humanitarian catastrophe in Syria, there are, quote, at least 1 million people who are now in need of urgent humanitarian assistance in Aleppo alone. And those are some of the news headlines of the past week on the Electronic Intifada. To read these stories and much more, visit electronicintifada.net. Rifat Al-Arir, Rawan Yahi, and Yusuf Al-Jamal are three contributors to the new book Gaza Writes Back, a collection of short stories that, as Al-Arir, who is also the editor, says in the introduction, records and commemorates in fiction the fifth anniversary of the full-scale military offensive, the so-called Operation Cast Lead. The book includes 23 short fiction pieces, a deliberate and significant number reflecting the 23 consecutive days of those attacks on Gaza, by 15 writers, 12 of them women. Al-Arir, Yahi, and Al-Jamal were among the last Palestinians to leave the Gaza Strip in late summer 2013, before the military crackdown in Egypt made leaving the Strip almost impossible. All three left in order to pursue higher education opportunities elsewhere. For the last month, the writers have been on a U.S. tour, reading from their book and talking to large audiences about their experiences in Gaza. A fourth writer, Sarah Ali, was supposed to join the U.S. tour, but the Israeli government refused to allow her to travel out of Gaza, even though the U.S. State Department granted her a visa. In her review of Gaza Writes Back on the Electronic Intifada, contributor Sarah Irving writes, quote, what this selection offers is something rather different, the fresh voices of young, teenage, and 20-something non-professional writers from Gaza, a group which is underrepresented in Palestinian literature and translation. These are the kind of voices we are more accustomed to finding in blogs, podcasts, or videos, far from the literary establishment and speaking of the challenges facing Palestinians in very different ways. But while many of these tales are filled with the kind of events and traumas we read of all too often in blogs and news articles about Gaza, they are genuine short stories. They have plots, suspense, characterization, psychological complexity, and, most of all, the deep sense of feeling that comes from the meeting of experience and artistic sensibility. I met the writers in Berkeley last week. Rifat Al-Arir and Yusuf Al-Jamal have contributed to the Electronic Intifada in the past. I began by asking Al-Arir, the editor of the book and a professor of English literature at the Islamic University of Gaza, to introduce himself and talk about why he was compelled to curate 23 short stories written by young adults in Gaza.
My name is Rifat Al-Arir. I am a Palestinian from Gaza. Gaza Writes Back is one of the most important projects I have worked on as a Palestinian academic. The Gaza Writes Back book came to mark the fifth anniversary of Operation Cast Lead, when Israel ruthlessly murdered more than 1,400 Palestinians and injured thousands and made homeless more than 20,000 Palestinians. At that time, as a young Palestinian living in Gaza, I realized that there's more I can do in order to resist Israeli oppression, Israeli racism and humiliation inflicted on Palestinians. We started writing on our blogs and publishing articles on Mondowise and the Electronic Intifada. And basically, after the war, everybody was writing, but mainly writing personal reflections and experiences. Later on, we realized that there is a very important step we have to take, which is to upgrade what we write into fiction in order to take the whole Palestine issue cause globally by fiction, because fiction is timeless and universal. And then we started holding some, my friends and I started holding and conducting some workshops and writing courses on creative writing, short story writing, poetry writing. And basically everybody started writing wonderful pieces because we live the pain, we live the experience, and writing about Palestine was not difficult, because at the same time we realized how important it was. So Gaza Writes Back came from these beliefs of the importance of writing back in order to bring the Palestinian voices, the Palestinian narrative out there. The book contains 23 short stories written in English by young people, and 12 of these young people are females.
Can you talk a little bit about the process of working with these writers? In short fiction and poetry, there's a lot of creative liberty that you can take. A lot of these stories are inspired, not all of them, but a lot of them are inspired by Operation Cast Lead. So what was it like being able to work with these writers and being able to cultivate these voices of creativity?
As a teacher of creative writing, I always believed that, I still do actually, that there's always a writer inside every one of us. All you need to do is do some poking. And that writing is an act of courage. You have to be courageous in order to believe that you can write. For these young Palestinians, they had the very good command of English and the understanding of the importance of their role as young Palestinians who have to do something for the struggle against oppression and racism. So every time we had, for example, a course on writing, on creative writing, we would have 20 students or 20 people joining from different universities. And sometimes I would invite people who I know can write. And we would usually start by reading samples of poetry, of short stories, and talk about them, discuss them, and take it from there. And instead of being on the recipient part where we just receive literature, we had to produce literature because that is what we intended to do from the first place. The other thing is that I decided to take this thing to my own classes at university, at the Islamic University where I teach. I started assigning my students to write fiction rather than research papers. And I usually had students coming to me and complaining that they have never written anything before, let alone write fiction. But again, with the discussions we would have in the class, with the samples and the training sessions we would hold, basically everybody started writing. Even the first story in Gaza writes back, called "L for Life" by Hanan Habashi. In my opinion, it's the best story in the book. And Hanan Habashi came to me the beginning of the term and said she hasn't written anything before and it's not easy for her to write. And I said, you have to start believing in yourself. As a Palestinian, you have the talent, you have the experience, you live the pain. All you need to do is just to put your pen on the paper and then words and ideas are going to flow naturally. And from these classes, we had so many amazing pieces that I collected and kept them somewhere. And later on, when Helena Koban of Just World Books contacted me, we discussed the idea of having a book from Gaza to mark the 5th anniversary of Operation Cast Lead. I announced this on my Facebook and elsewhere that I'm working on a book of short stories. If you have ever written a short story, if you can write a short story, please send me whatever you have. And if you are willing to adapt, to develop, and try to write a short story, we will be holding a training course at CBDS, where Yusuf works, to train young people who want to write a short story. And we started receiving tens of pieces.
Rawan, could you introduce yourself? Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Rawan Yahri. I'm 20 years old. I'm currently studying in the UK. I used to study at the Islamic University of Gaza. I did English literature there, and now I'm doing linguistics.
And had you ever written short fiction before?
Yes, I started writing short fiction when I was 17, and most of my pieces were about children and their point of view when they experience, loss and war and destruction.
And you have several pieces in Gaza Writes Back that are written from the perspective of young people, of children, especially during the attacks in 2008, 2009. Can you talk about why it's important for you to pick a child as the narrator in your stories?
Because during Operation Cast Lead, I would stay at home with my family like everyone else, and we heard about stories of children going through really difficult situations, like being trapped under rubble or losing their relatives or witnessing the death of their parents. And I was always afraid of having to go through this myself. And I wasn't even that young. I was 16. And I felt if it's so terrifying for me, how would it feel for a child? So I thought a child's experience must be talked about, must be exposed, so that, you know, it doesn't happen to more children in the world.
Could I ask you to read one of your pieces from Gaza Writes Back?
Sure. A Wall is a short story about the separation wall in the West Bank, and it talks about a young person just walking next to the wall and thinking to himself or herself. A wall. It's funny there's a sidewalk here. I walked with my fingertips touching the huge blocks of the great wall built to scare me. I didn't look at the graffiti. I know it very well. The sky was half eaten by the wall, and the sun was no better. I tripped on a stone, probably thrown by some of my friends yesterday. I sat down where I stumbled and grabbed the stone, stared at it for a minute, and threw it over the wall. I listened for an ouch, a curse word, footsteps, a call, a whisper, or a gunshot. Nothing. I kept on walking. It didn't seem to end. My fingertips were now stained with all graffiti colors. I stopped. I turned my face to the wall. I put both my hands on it. I pushed. I kept pushing. My arms straight, my teeth clenched, my legs rooted to the ground, the smell of the spray paint going through my nostrils to my lungs. A man walking past me stopped to see what would come out of this. My feet started backing the other way. A sound from inside me broke out into a scream. I collapsed to the ground crying. The man laughed and went on walking.
Rowan, thank you so much. And Yusuf Al-Jamal, you're no stranger to the Electronic Intifada. Tell us a little bit about yourself and where you've been the last, actually, 9 months. And why you wanted to contribute to Gaza Writes Back.
My name is Yusuf Al-Jamal. I am a Palestinian refugee from the Gaza Strip, from Nusayrat refugee camp. A contributor to Electronic Intifada and Gaza Writes Back. Currently, I'm doing master's in international relations in Malaysia. Omar X, my story that I contributed to Gaza Writes Back is deeply rooted in my family's reality. It's the story of my oldest brother who was shot dead in 2004 by Israeli soldiers who invaded our refugee camps and shot 14 Palestinians dead, including my oldest brother and his friend. The story tries to capture the last moments in Omar's life when he was bleeding, because the following day when he was shot, I rushed to the site of the killing and I found some of Omar's belongings on the ground, including his cell phone. And when I checked the call history, I found out that he was trying to call the family, probably to say a last goodbye, but he couldn't because of the advanced Israeli military that cut off all sorts of communication in that area. Israeli snipers didn't allow, of course, the paramedics to transfer him to the hospital. As a result, he passed away. So I try to imagine what he was thinking of, the things that he wanted to tell to the family when he was bleeding. And since we were on his mind until the very last moments in his life, this story is to immortalize him through fiction, to remember him, to make him memorable, to educate people all over the world about him and the other 13 Palestinians who were killed that day in Nusayrat refugee camp. This was not the end of the story. The story is entitled Omar X because 2 years later my mother delivered another baby boy and, as expected, named him after my oldest brother. So I ended up with two brothers named Omar. One is the oldest and one is the youngest. So this story is also about my youngest brother who had to live in the shadow of my oldest brother who was murdered by Israel.
And you've been a journalist for many years. How is it kind of switching gears and kind of diving into fiction?
This is the first time I write fiction ever. I have written many articles, nonfiction, about the personal experience of my family and personal experience of other people under occupation. I think going fiction is not that different. However, it's completely different. Mm-hmm. Because I write about personal experiences and I feel very much involved in writing when I write fiction or nonfiction because I talk about my personal experience. When I write fiction, I have to make few changes, add new characters, but still the story is there, the same story. The truth is there. It doesn't change. Omar X. The night was silent. The moon hid behind some summer clouds. His smile revealed his young age. His steps beat the ground slowly, looking for the path. The thump-thump sound of a helicopter was getting closer, penetrating the peace of the crowded refugee camp his family had lived in since 1948. And the familiar noise of tanks rolling in violated the silence of the night and decreed that he would never sleep again. He got into his khaki uniform hastily, grabbed his gun, and rubbing its dusty barrel, stormed out of the house. As he waited a little at the doorstep of their house to make sure no one was watching, his eyes wandered right and left, and finally met the eyes of his friend, who was murdered 3 months ago and is now immortalized in posters stuck on the walls of the camp. Those honey eyes of his best friend always brought him comfort. As the helicopter moved away for a while, silence prevailed again. Soon after, Saad joined him, and together they entered an orange orchard. Saad insisted on going in first. Omar followed after Saad made sure no soldiers were around. The place must be safe. Let's get closer to that building in the middle. We can see things clearer from there, Omar suggested in a whisper. The grass under their feet was fresh. The only noise they could hear was that of the branches rubbing against them as they went further. Saad stopped to check his gun. Omar did the same. They stood still for a second. Silence was heard again, this time even clearer. It all made sense now. That silence was artificial. Omar and Saad didn't have time to communicate except for some glances. Bullets poured from the building into them. Omar fell down, shot. Watch out, crawl on the ground, Saad, still in disbelief, shouted. More bullets whizzed by. Despite her love for her first son, Omar's mother could do nothing to stop him. She wanted him to study hard to pass his high school final exams. Just study hard this year, then you can put off your education for a few years. Omar suggested, urging him to focus on his school. I'll bring you a certificate that will make you raise your head proudly high in the sky, Omar would say to comfort his increasingly worried mother. As he played, a song he loved and always sang jumped to his mind. My mother prepared me a comfortable bed. She made me a leather pillow and wished me eternal happiness. This is your bride, shining like a diamond. Omar was too fragile to take out his mobile and make a last call to his family. He kept bleeding, and the bullets kept coming. He swung his head to his right. Face down, Saad was lying lifeless next to him. He gathered enough strength and extended his hand over Saad's body. And before he could do anything, his hand fell down.
Thank you, Yusuf. That's great. Rifat, finally, how has it been touring the U.S., and what kind of response has this book and these fabulous writers gotten so far?
It's been fantastic so far. We've been to all sorts of places, university campuses, churches, synagogues, all sorts of gatherings. We met all sorts of people. The reaction to people who we spoke to was really amazing all the time. We heard from people who read the book and reacted positively to it, recommending it to their friends and family. But most importantly, we had to meet wonderful people from all walks of life, mainly Palestinians born and raised here, very active for Palestine, for BDS. We've met so wonderful people like Ali Abu Nama and others. We also met, and this is very important to me personally, we met so many Jewish people working for justice for Palestine. This is something Israel does not want us to know as Palestinians, that there are many Jewish people who work for Palestine. For us, Gaza Rights Back is only one project, one drop. We're hoping that many other books from us and from other Palestinians and pro-Palestinians would follow, because we believe in the power of the word. We believe in the power of the word, how it mobilizes for the just cause of Palestine. We believe that writing more is going to bring more people around us Palestinians, to bring equal rights, to end Israeli racism and occupation, and guarantee the right of return to all Palestinians.
And the book is called Gaza Rights Back. It's published by Just World Books. Rifat Alarir, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast. All of you, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nora.
And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
And that concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine. Join us again next week for another edition here on WZBC Newton.